Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano. On today's program, you'll be hearing a speech given by Angela Davis. I recorded this speech in mid-February 2002 at an event at the University of California in Berkeley. The event was called 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State. Angela Davis is an activist, writer, former political prisoner, professor in the history of consciousness at the University of California in Santa Cruz, author of Women, Race, and Class, among other books, Angela Davis.
Thank you. I really like the way this theme, 21st century McCarthyism, which appropriately characterizes the swift intensification and reconsolidation of the right wing in the aftermath of the attack on September 11, but also, and I think this is important, compels us to try to think about the present in historical perspective. Of course, it's always pointed out that one of the central prerequisites of Americanness is historical amnesia. Since this is Black History Month, we only have, a few more days to celebrate Black History Month, the shortest month of the year. I want to frame my presentation with the observation that this historical amnesia that we often make light of has real consequences. It renders our historical memory inaccessible precisely when we need it to shape critical analyses about the present. I mean, for example, Dr. Martin Luther King, who's been celebrated and celebrated and celebrated since January 15, and of course, he's perhaps the major figure celebrated during Black History Month. But rarely have we been urged to explore his contribution to the peace movement, his pivotal stance against the war in Vietnam at a time when other prominent public figures were afraid to stand up and speak out against the war in Vietnam. And I wonder to what extent this celebration focuses also on the anti-communist and racist repression to which he was subjected. Now, of course, it's about celebrating the dream. But what are the lessons we might learn about the need for political resistance today by looking more closely at the meaning of Dr. Martin Luther King's legacy. But the example I want to dwell on somewhat this evening is W.E.B. Du Bois. Like many others, scholars, artists, union leaders, members of the Communist Party, supporters of progressive causes, Du Bois was a victim of McCarthyism. Almost 40 years have passed since his death, and as we know, his scholarly contributions have only just begun to receive the widespread acclaim they deserve, perhaps during the last 10 years or so. The Du Bois of Souls of Black Folk, the Philadelphia Negro perhaps, and certainly Black Reconstruction is fairly well known. Perhaps best known is his observation in 1900 at the London Pan-African Congress that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. Du Bois had this amazing ability to pin these wonderful, pithy aphorisms. And I want to point to one that has not circulated as widely as we might want. And this one is about his own case. In February, I think it was February 16th, 1951, he was arraigned on charges of being serving as an agent for a foreign principal. It is a curious thing, he wrote, that today I am called upon to defend myself against criminal charges for openly advocating the one thing all people want, peace. Now, Du Bois was approaching 83 years old. When he issued the statement containing these words. He had been arrested, fingerprinted, searched for weapons. He had been handcuffed. As the chairperson of this new organization that was called the Peace Information Center, this was his crime, he had taken up the project of publicizing and circulating the Stockholm Peace Appeal. This is 1951, several years after the dropping of two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And therefore, peace organizations from all over the world had come together in Stockholm and had decided to launch a major peace initiative calling for nuclear disarmament. And so Du Bois was charged with failing to register the Peace Information Center, which he chaired, as, quote, an agent of a foreign principal within the United States. The implication, of course, was that it was absolutely unpatriotic to speak out against the bomb. It was unpatriotic to call for disarmament. According to Du Bois's biographer, David Levering Lewis, around this time, an enormous 83rd birthday celebration had been scheduled to take place at the Essex House. Those of you who know New York know that the Essex House is one of the most luxurious hotels in New York. As a result of his arrest, the hotel annulled the contract, and many prominent people an array of prominent people who had initially agreed to be a part of Du Bois's birthday celebration, including Margaret Mead, yes, Margaret Mead, and Ralph Bunche, yes, Ralph Bunche. So instead of holding the birthday celebration at this deluxe hotel in Midtown Manhattan, the celebration was held at Small's Paradise, which is a restaurant in Harlem. And I could talk a little bit about the celebration, but I don't have time. So I want to move on and raise this question. How many people, upon hearing this story, which unfolded in 1951, would attribute the criminalization of peace activism during the McCarthy era as a kind of political backwardness that we have since overcome, so much so that it is quite unnecessary to hold these moments in our historical memories. After all, that time is long past. Du Bois may have been considered a traitor because he advocated nuclear disarmament. He may have been divested of his passport for eight years, but that happened a long time ago. That could not happen in the America of today. But let's fast forward to February 19th, 2002. The New York Times. U.S. forces appear to have opened a new phase in the war in Afghanistan with two bombing raids over the weekend that Afghan commanders said were aimed at ending a challenge by local militia forces to fighters loyal to the eight-week interim government in Kabul. Is it considered unpatriotic today to challenge U.S. foreign policy? Or perhaps even only to observe that we thought that when the U.S. troops were first sent out, they were going to fight a war against terrorism. They were supposed to be hunting al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Now, does this war on terrorism require us to assent to this permanent military presence in Afghanistan, perhaps designed to make Afghanistan safe for the oil pipeline from Turkmenistan? Does this putative war against terrorism require us to assent to any and all military actions in Central Asia, or perhaps in Iraq or Iran, or maybe in North Korea, to name the three countries that Bush currently designates as the axis of evil? What strikes me most about the similarities between the current moment and the era we call McCarthyism is the unquestioned assumption in public discourse that it is appropriate to construct foreign policy as a strategy of overcoming fear. Evil, of course, is the most fearful thing we can imagine. Osama bin Laden was represented as the anthropomorphic face of evil, the only response to him being an all-embracing fear. And of course, it shouldn't be necessary to point out that this is in no way to render insignificant the horrible events of September 11th, the enormous loss of life, the ubiquitous agony these attacks occasion. It is only to question the political strategies of creating what is often referred to as a moral panic, strategies shared by McCarthyism and the Bush war on terrorism. During the McCarthy era, it was not only, and perhaps not even primarily, the organized right wing that was responsible for the speed with which communism came to be viewed as the face of evil, and for the purging of people suspected of being communists or suspected of working with or being friends with communists. This was the case of Du Bois. The communist pariah was discovered anywhere and everywhere, and liberals played leading roles in purging the universities, the Hollywood film industry, the labor unions, and other organizations of suspected communist or fellow travelers. And like Jennifer, I want to ask you to permit me a personal aside, because I can remember the shadowy FBI figures following my family often on everyday outings to visit an aunt in the Bronx, for example, because my mother was friends with a number of Communist Party members. I can tell you stories about the treatment my mother received after I was fired from my position at UCLA in 1969 because of my membership in the Communist Party. And of course, this was when we had allegedly already emerged from the McCarthy era. But these are tangential stories for another time. The point of all of this is to suggest some connections that we may not have noticed between the contemporary political discourse on terrorism that has helped us to accept the war on Afghanistan as inevitable, and the older discourse against communism that justified so many wars and the domestic aggression of anti-communism. I wonder if I need to point out that racism figures in to these discourses. I should perhaps say that to point to a couple of historical figures. Henry Winston, an African-American man who served as chair of the Communist Party and who spent many years in a federal penitentiary after being convicted under the Smith Act, always emphasized the part racism played in reinforcing anti-communism. So did Claudia Jones, who came to the U.S. from the West Indies and began to work against the persecution of the Scottsboro Nine. She, of course, was convicted under the Smith Act, imprisoned, and then deported to England because she held a British passport. I mentioned racism. When we consider also the masculinist face of the war against terror and the extent to which patriarchal and sexist, heterosexist ideas have been reconsolidated during this period, we might also want to remember that homophobia played a significant role in the success of McCarthyism. Now, looking back at the popular understanding that appeared to emerge immediately and spontaneously in the aftermath of September 11th, that nothing would ever be the same. I mean, we heard this over and over again. Nothing will ever be the same. We can now interpret this as a dangerous preparation for the enormous erosion of civil liberties in the following months. The notion that nothing would ever be the same was repeatedly pronounced by government officials, it was rehearsed by the media, and it seemed to capture the popular sentiment that the country was indeed prepared for a drastic shift in the way we lead our lives, including the increased surveillance and policing represented as necessary to defeat terrorism. The California Highway Patrol, as you probably read now, is trying to get many more millions of dollars because they represent themselves as being on the front line of the struggle against terrorism. They have to guard the bridges. They have to, anyway. As has been frequently the case in U.S. history, racist assumptions were mobilized to define the enemy. And within a matter of days, the already repressive conditions experienced by immigrant communities increased astronomically. Thus, practices of racial profiling that have long been a target of anti-racist activism were more intensely deployed on Arab, Middle Eastern, South Asian and Muslim communities. The swift passage by Congress of the USA Patriot and so-called anti-terrorism bill without any discussion whatever, without any public discussion at all, with all of its repressive provisions for deportation and detention and surveillance, has brought about a drastic curtailment of civil liberties, which will be extremely difficult to reverse. Thus, there are sinister parallels with the McCarthy era. And those of us who have been active in the anti-prison movement for the last decade or so have noticed a striking resemblance between the representation of the terrorist and the representation of the criminal. In many ways, the public was already prepared for the mobilization of nationalist emotions based on fear of a racialized enemy. This had already occurred in connection with the so-called war on crime, with the emergence of a vast prison industrial complex, which not only promoted the popular ideological assumptions that safety and security were a function of the imprisonment of vast numbers of people of color, but also in the process criminalized undocumented immigrants. The expansion of the INS as an apparatus of policing and imprisonment was, as we can see now, a dangerous rehearsal for the present moment. McCarthyism kindled up dangerous and aggressive nationalist emotions. This is also just such a moment when fear is mobilized on behalf of the nation, which is now a multicultural America, though still engaged in terrifying acts of exclusion. Muslims, Arabs, Middle Easterners, Central Asians, South Asians, and those who appear to fit these labels are constructed as the outsiders who occasion the shutting down of the nation. This is yet another horrifying face of racism. Racism has always been deeply linked to nationalism, whose logical conclusion is always repression and war. There are many other points, like Jennifer and Diane, that I would have liked to have made, but given the time restraints, I want to conclude with a passage from Paul Robeson's Here I Stand, and a few comments. And I offer these words from another victim of McCarthyism, Paul Robeson. This is Black History Month. For the lessons they may bring us today. Okay, this was, Here I Stand was published in 1958, I believe. Those who tell the world that racism in American life is merely a fading hangover from the past, this was in 1958, he was saying this, and that it is largely limited to one section of our country, cannot explain away the infamous Walter McCarran Immigration Act passed by Congress since the war. No decree of Nazi Germany was more fully racist than this law, which is, in the words of Senator Lehman, quote, based on the same discredited racial theories from which Adolf Hitler developed the infamous Nuremberg laws. And, unquote, Robeson goes on, look how our immigration quotas are allotted. From Ireland's 3 million people, 17,000 may come to our country each year. But from India, with her 400 millions, the quota is 100. And he goes on to say, usually we Negroes do not think much about immigration laws because we've been here for centuries. But in our midst, there are many from the West Indies, and their talents and vitality have been important to our communities far beyond their numbers. Under the Walter McCarran Law, with all of its provisions to reduce non-Nordic immigration, the number of Negroes who can come from the Caribbean or anywhere else has been drastically cut down. So I think that this Black History Month should carry the message that if Black communities, communities of color, any progressive formations want to live up to that legacy of struggle for a new and better world, we need to oppose racial profiling no matter who is the target. We need to follow Dr. King's call for justice without recourse to bullets and bombs, and stand up against the war in Afghanistan. And in the aftermath of September 11, social movements have an even greater responsibility to propose radical critiques of the government, not only to organize visible protests, but to help change the popular discourse that equates the actions of the government with the interests of the people. The patriotism that emerged as a marketable commodity in the aftermath of the attacks, allowing the U.S. flag to adorn every imaginable aspect of daily life, did not cause the fear to wane, but rather established an array of enemies to be feared as intensely as people learn to fear the possibility of another attack. While some enemies became obvious immediately, Middle Easterners, South Asians, Arabs, Muslims, other enemies, immigrant rights organizers, anti-racist and other social justice organizations are also on the agenda. This means that political reconfigurations after September 11th, you know, for example, the dangerous reluctance of congresspersons with the single exception of Barbara Lee to speak out against war, have resulted in a more generalized conservatism. This conservatism makes the work of radical organizations, some of which have exercised self-censorship, far more difficult. It seems to me that if we think about McCarthyism and its construction of the un-American, and as the nation as constituting the limits of identity, community, and solidarity, then our current challenge is to imagine identity, community, and solidarities that exceed this nationalism. Perhaps we should learn how to be unafraid of being foreign agents, as Du Bois was designated, if foreign means beyond the nation. Perhaps this is where we need to be to globally defend the rights of immigrants in Fortress Europe, in North America, in Australia, to speak out against sweatshops and the super exploitation of women and girls, to organize against the global prison industrial complex, and yes, to understand that capitalism is not a synonym for democracy. Thank you.
That was Angela Davis speaking at a conference, 21st Century McCarthyism and the Rise of the Global Police State, at UC Berkeley in mid-February 2002. I'm Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.